From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
All the decades of deceit and cruelty have now reached an end. Saddam Hussein and his sons must leave Iraq within 48 hours. Their refusal to do so will result in military conflict, commenced at a time of our choosing. For their own safety, all foreign nationals, including journalists and inspectors, should leave Iraq immediately.
President Bush brings the world to the edge of war. We'll hear from former UN Assistant Secretary General Dennis Halliday.
The only hope we have is the people of the United States of America. The rest of us overseas have marched and talked and worked, and it makes no difference to a man like Bush. Only his own political career, his re-election in 2004, really count. I think he's got to get a signal, a very clear signal from millions upon millions of Americans that this behavior, this action is totally unacceptable across this great country. And he's got to get that message in 48 hours, let's say, if not sooner.
Then we go to Indiana, where a decorated Gulf War veteran, Lewis Jones Jr., was just executed. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. This is the War and Peace Report. President Bush last night vowed to attack Iraq if President Saddam Hussein and his sons do not flee the country within 48 hours. President Bush addressed the nation on primetime television. The Iraqi government immediately rejected the ultimatum. Bush also told Iraqi soldiers not to fight for a dying regime and not to destroy Iraq's oil wells. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan ordered the evacuation of the weapons inspectors and humanitarian staff from the country. The first wave of UN workers has already landed in Cyprus. Kofi Annan also suspended the Oil for Food program. Bush's speech came just hours after the U.S. and Britain admitted they'd failed to win U.N. Security Council backing for war. They pulled the second U.N. resolution without taking a vote. U.N. Secretary General Kofi Annan challenged the legitimacy of unilateral military action, but refrained from branding it illegal. In Britain, three ministers have already resigned. The leader of the British House of Commons, Robin Cook, resigned just after the U.S. and Britain pulled the U.N. resolution. His resignation speech late last night was met with an unprecedented round of applause and a standing ovation by some members of Parliament. Today, Home Office Minister John Denham and Health Minister Lord Hunt of King's Heath also resigned. But International Development Secretary Clare Short announced she would stay in her cabinet post despite earlier threats to resign. Russian President Vladimir Putin called for a peaceful resolution, said a U.S. attack would have the, quote, gravest consequences. Meanwhile, the Russian parliament delayed ratification of a major nuclear disarmament treaty with the U.S. A parliamentary spokesman said the decision was made after Bush's declaration and, quote, in the conditions of the massive U.S. pressure on the international community. French Foreign Minister Dominique de Villepin denounced the United States for pulling the resolution from the UN. He said a wide majority of the 15 members of the Security Council oppose the U.S. He said the U.S., Britain, and Spain are resorting to force, quote, despite the clearly expressed will of the international community. German Chancellor Gerhard Schroeder said today there is no justification for war that will, quote, bring certain death to thousands of innocent men, women, and children. Chinese Premier Wen Jiabao opposed Bush's ultimatum to Saddam Hussein and held out hope of a diplomatic solution. This news just in from Yemen. An American, a Canadian, and a Yemeni were shot dead in an attack by a Yemeni gunman who then killed himself at an oil field east of Sana'a. The U.S. government raised its terrorist threat level to orange or high risk last night as President Bush was delivering his speech on Iraq. Top federal officials ask states to deploy the National Guard or state police to protect sensitive sites across the nation from possible attack. A Vatican spokesperson told Vatican Radio, quote, "War is a crime against peace which cries for vengeance before God." He said war is deeply unjust and immoral and said God condemns war because civilians suffer the most. Archbishop Renato Rafael Martino is the Vatican's former permanent representative to the United Nations. He strongly denounced the Bush administration, quote, "Do not reply with a stone to the child who asks for bread." He said, quote, "They are preparing to reply with thousands of bombs to a people that has been asking for bread for the last 12 years. The Turkish government and military leaders have reached agreement on allowing U.S. troops to use Turkey as a northern front in an attack on Iraq. The cabinet will discuss the measure today, and Parliament could take up the issue tomorrow. The Parliament has voted against the deployment of U.S. troops in Turkey several days ago. Meanwhile, protesters are engaging in daily nonviolent direct actions around the country this week. Over 50 people were arrested in Washington, D.C. yesterday. Dozens more were arrested at the United Nations in New York City and in San Francisco. We'll have more on that story in our second hour.
America, indeed the world, is under attack from a sinister force led by a boy. The world's most powerful boy. Owlboy.
Dear Daddy. Dear Daddy.
Owlboy. Up in the sky. It's a bird. It's a plane. It's the boy who loves to dish out pain.
Owlboy.
Sacrifice me and you. Once 100 more be two. For the power, for the few.
The entire world, is
Power Boy. It's not your planet to destroy.
The entire world is a battlefield.
Drunk with the power, he's more scary by the hour. While the planet gets devoured, Power Boy.
Power Boy, Patriotica, here on Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Bush last night vowed to attack Iraq if President Saddam Hussein and his sons do not flee the country within 48 hours. President Bush addressed the nation on primetime television.
The United States and other nations did nothing to deserve or invite this threat, but we will do everything to defeat it. Instead of drifting along toward tragedy, we will set a course toward safety. Before the day of horror can come, before it is too late to act, this danger will be removed. The United States of America has the sovereign authority to use force in assuring its own national security. That duty falls to me as Commander-in-Chief. By the oath I have sworn, by the oath I will keep. Recognizing the threat to our country, the United States Congress voted overwhelmingly last year to support the use of force against Iraq. America tried to work with the United Nations to address this threat because we wanted to resolve the issue peacefully. We believe in the mission of the United Nations. One reason the UN was founded after the Second World War was to confront aggressive dictators actively and early, before they can attack the innocent and destroy the peace. In the case of Iraq, the Security Council did act in the early 1990s. Under resolutions 678 and 687, both still in effect, the United States and our allies are authorized to use force in ridding Iraq of weapons of mass destruction. This is not a question of authority. It is a question of will.
President George Bush addressing the nation last night. In our studios last night, just after Bush gave his address, we were joined by Dennis Halliday. Dennis Halliday is the former assistant UN Secretary General. He was with the United Nations for more than 30 years. then became head of the oil for food program in Iraq, then quit, calling the sanctions regime genocidal. After we speak with Dennis Halliday, we will talk to a veteran of the Persian Gulf War about how he feels now, and particularly his contention that U.S. troops are not prepared for a biochemical attack. We turn now to Dennis Halliday and his response.
Well, he started off by saying that 12 years of diplomacy have failed. He forgot to mention that 12 years of sanctions have not only failed, but have killed probably over 1 million Iraqis, particularly young children. Sanctions that have been sustained by the United States and Britain in particular, punishing the Iraqi people collectively in breach of international law for crimes or for weapons that their government holds, nothing to do with them as civilians of the country.
Did anything he said surprise you?
He said we were a country of peace, and that is a strange statement coming out of his very aggressive stand and military ambitions to go to war against Iraq. He didn't give us the truth. He told us about weapons of mass destruction. He forgot to mention oil and control of oil. He forgot to mention his colonial ambitions and ambitions for American empire in the Middle East. He forgot to tell us about the need to have a military presence, apparently, in the Middle East when Iraq is invaded and occupied. He forgot to inform us of his blind support of Israel and Israeli genocide against the Palestinians. He left out a few details.
What about George Bush saying last week that no matter what, he would call for a vote at the UN Security Council on a second resolution, and now backing off, seeing that he's not going to get that, and saying they have withdrawn the resolution?
Yes, very strange behavior. One can only assume that there's an element of inexperience in the regime in Washington at the moment vis-a-vis the United Nations. They've brought in some strange people. General Powell himself obviously is not experienced as a diplomat, nor with the United Nations. I think he's just been badly advised, and clearly he's fallen on his face.
What does this mean right now, this Operation Shock and Awe, for the people of Iraq, whom you have worked with in Iraq and have visited since?
I think it means that we'll see photographs, we'll see shots of families being destroyed, of children being blown apart, of heads being literally taken off small bodies. We'll see families, homes, the streets littered with rubble and human remains. I mean, this is going to be the most cruel, I think, devastating military attack on the towns and cities of this country, where the majority of Iraqis live, where they're planning to stay because they have nowhere else to go. They don't have basements. They don't have ways of hiding themselves from the horror of United States military endeavors. These high-flying heroes at 30,000 feet who will drop ordnance on Iraqi children, Iraqi people, without regard to life. It's a form of terrorism, I think, of the very worst kind, endorsed by a president who doesn't seem to be more high-minded or more idealistic or more suitable for leadership than perhaps bin Laden or perhaps Saddam Hussein himself.
What about what Blair is facing for the support of Bush? The latest news, Robin Cook, the cabinet member who has just resigned.
Well, Mr. Blair has dug himself a very deep hole. It's rather hard to understand. He's a man of some intelligence, clearly. But a bit like Mr. Bush, he's somewhat messianic, born again, simplistic, everything's black or white or good or evil. But he certainly alienated himself from within the Labour Party, from his own members, from his own cabinet. One wonders how long he will survive. I would guess he'd be overthrown like Thatcher was by the Conservatives and replaced by somebody more representative of Britain and British requirements.
In Bush's speech, he encouraged all foreign nationals, including journalists and inspectors, to leave Iraq immediately. It made me think about Rachel Corrie, the 23-year-old American woman who was killed by Israeli troops on Sunday in Gaza as she was trying to stop another housing demolition. The Israeli tank drove over her and then reversed and drove back over her. She was an American observer with the International Solidarity Movement. And the threat that these observers, whether Rachel Corrie in Gaza, pose, or journalists, inspectors in Iraq.
I think that the presence of foreigners is seen by the Bush regime to be dangerous. A woman like Rachel Corrie, with her courage, is just extraordinary for all of us, I think, to witness and hopefully to endorse and try to follow. It's very threatening to Mr. Bush and the people around him in Washington. And I think that's true of foreigners in Iraq, whether they're United Nations or they're inspectors. They simply get in the way, and we know Mr. Bush doesn't tolerate that sort of nonsense.
And finally, on the issue of where the media is going to go right now, this new term, the embedded journalist, not to be confused with the journalist embed with the military, but embedded journalists, with journalists now having to leave Iraq, but going in with the military. FAIR has come out with a new study, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. In Iraq crisis, networks are megaphones for official views. Study finds TV marginalizing dissenting voices. It says network newscasts dominated by current and former U.S. officials largely exclude Americans who are skeptical of or opposed to an invasion of Iraq. Looking at 2 weeks of coverage from January 30th to February 12th, FAIR examined close to 400 on-camera sources who appeared in nightly news stories about Iraq on ABC World News Tonight, CBS Evening News, NBC Nightly News, and PBS's NewsHour with Jim Lehrer. The study began 1 week before and ended 1 week after Secretary of State Colin Powell's February 5th presentation to the UN, a time that saw particularly intense debate about the idea of a war against Iraq on the national and international level. More than two-thirds of the guests featured were from the United States. Of the U.S. guests, three-quarters were either current or former government or military officials. Only one of the official U.S. sources, Senator Edward Kennedy, expressed skepticism or opposition to the war. Even this was couched in vague terms. Similarly, when both U.S. and non-U.S. guests were included, more than three-quarters were either current or retired officials. Such a predominance of official sources virtually assures that independent and grassroots perspectives will be underrepresented. Your comment on the role that the media plays in this country, and you travel a lot and you come from Ireland and spend time in many other places, in this drive for war?
Well, I think it's very sad to know that the American people do not get the news as news. They get it as entertainment. They do not get to see both sides of a situation. They're not allowed to, apparently, to understand what happens when you go to war. They're not aware of the consequences. This is very, I think, dangerous and very sad, and it means that we have an ill-informed populace in this country who are seeing war being turned into a game, made attractive, exciting, romantic almost. It's bizarre to see this happening. And I myself always turn to the BBC in New York to try to get another perspective on what's happening. And the BBC could do some work also. We saw the New York Times coming out with some excellent pieces recently, op-ed and editorial pieces. But, you know, by and large, the average American doesn't see that quality of coverage, whether it's BBC or New York Times. They rely on very basic information sources, and they are being misled, I think, tragically.
It's quite something. The UN clearly was not going, the UN Security Council, to support George Bush in his push for war. What was your take on a story that hardly got any coverage in this country? And that was the UN spying story, the U.S. spying story. A National Security Agency document came out, more top secret than the CIA, the NSA, saying that they would conduct a surge on the UN Security Council diplomats, specifically the African countries like Guinea, Cameroon, Angola, Pakistan, Bulgaria, and eavesdrop on, bug their home and office phones, their faxes, their emails. And this was also sent to British intelligence to help with this spying. You're a veteran of the UN of more than 30 years. Did this surprise you? And also the fact that in this country, it got almost no play.
No, this did not surprise me. In fact, it reminds me of 1944 and 1945 in San Francisco, when the United States bugged the delegations who were negotiating the charter. It's exactly the same story, just a few years on. And it's an indication, I think, of the contempt that the United States has for the United Nations and the sovereignty of the Security Council and the sovereignty of member states who make up the United Nations.
And what is your comment now as the U.S., I still won't say war is inevitable, but as Bush says that he gives Saddam Hussein 48 hours to flee Iraq, your thought on where this will lead and what people can do? Do you think this is a time where people just give up?
No. I like you, I'm struggling to find some optimistic sense somewhere deep in my soul. And I think the only key, the only hope we have is the people of the United States of America. The rest of us overseas have marched and talked and worked, and it makes no difference to a man like Bush. Only his own political career, his re-election in 2004, really count. I think he's got to get a signal, a very clear signal from millions upon millions of Americans that this behavior, this action is totally unacceptable across this great country. And he's got to get that message in 48 hours, let's say, if not sooner. Because what he's established for Baghdad is a schedule which is unworkable and unreal, which seems to indicate that war is certainly on his mind. But we can be hopeful, but I think only hopeful if the American people somehow rise up and take over their own country and make democracy work.
That was Dennis Halliday, Assistant Secretary General of the United Nations, responding to George Bush's ultimatum for war. When we come back, we'll talk to a Gulf War veteran. Back in a minute.
Hey, we shall overcome. We shall overcome. We shall overcome someday. Darling, in my heart, yeah, I do believe we shall. We'll walk hand in hand. We'll walk hand in hand. We'll walk hand in hand someday. Darling, here in my heart, here I do believe.
You are listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Casualties. U.S. casualties, Iraqi casualties. What will be the number? After the Persian Gulf War, when General Powell was asked about Iraqis dead, he said, "We don't count the enemy dead." And what about the United States? Ask many veterans of the Persian Gulf, and they say casualties can't be measured by the 148 who died or the 500 wounded in battle. In the 12 years since, nearly 164,000 Gulf vets, about 28% of those who served, have been certified by government doctors for service-related medical claims, more than twice the rate of World War II, Korea, and Vietnam. The Veterans Administration doesn't track how many of those are suffering from Gulf War syndrome, but the government's own studies consistently show that up to 30% of Gulf vets are sufferers. Now, as some 300,000 troops await orders to strike Iraq again, a cadre of Gulf veterans worry that the same epidemic of unexplained illnesses threatens a new generation of soldiers and perhaps their children. Steve Robinson is with us right now. He's executive director of the National Gulf War Resource Center in Washington, D.C., and he himself is a Persian Gulf vet. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning.
It's good to have you with us. You wrote a letter to President Bush. Can you tell us what you said?
I did, along with several other high-ranking, knowledgeable people who have both fought in wars and understand the cost of war. We wrote a letter to the president basically saying that there were significant deficiencies that were not being reported to the public and the media, and especially to the troops who were getting ready to deploy and who have deployed. These deficiencies consisted of army audits and government accounting reports that talked about whether or not we were prepared to fight a chemical and biological battle. Specifically, the most startling things out of the reports were that 62% of the gas masks and 90% of the chemical detectors our troops would currently use were reported to be defective just a year ago. We're not sure how much they have changed within 1 year, and we haven't had the government respond to the questions that we've asked about what have they fixed. But additionally, there were public laws that were designed to protect soldiers that were written and ratified in 1998 that said, because we don't want to have another mystery illness and because we don't want to have another 12 years of delays, denials, and obfuscation from the government, we're going to take baseline samples of soldiers before they go by drawing their blood and screening them medically to ensure they're fit before they depart. And then we're going to draw their blood and screen them medically when they return. We have since found out that the Department of Defense did not, in accordance with the public law, draw the blood from the soldiers. So potentially we may have a situation where there is no baseline data and they will be able to hold up their hands and say, sorry, we didn't draw the blood, therefore we can't do the measurements. Now, why is this important? It's important because just 3 weeks ago, the Institute of Medicine released a report that talked about pesticides and solvents used in the first Gulf War. And although they concluded that these pesticides and solvents by themselves or in combinations caused health effects, and there's well-documented evidence to show it in the civilian world, they couldn't draw the link that Gulf War veterans were ill because of pesticides and solvents exposure because there was no baseline data drawn and there was no blood sampling taken from soldiers when they returned. You may know that we can look at blood down to the molecular level. We can see changes in cells, but if we don't get the data first and then draw it when the soldiers return, then we're not able to answer the riddle. And so we wrote a letter to the president, basically putting on the record the fact that we knew this wasn't being done, and that spurred other letters to be written by senators and congressmen. Senator Kerry called for a government accounting investigation. Senator Feinstein and Feingold wrote letters to Secretary Rumsfeld, and Congressman Christopher Shays is going to hold hearings that will happen on the 25th of this month, in which my organization will testify about the deficiencies and about the fact that the public law is being ignored. Unfortunately, all of this seems too little too late, as it appears that we are 48 hours away from war.
We're talking to Steve Robinson, Gulf War veteran, executive director of the National Gulf War Resource Center, looking at the latest Reuters piece on the prospect of another Gulf War, bringing with it renewed concerns about exposure to nerve gas on the battlefield, as well as fears of a potential chemical attack by terrorists. Let's talk about the sources of the chemical exposure. While President Bush talks about terrorist attack and talks about Saddam Hussein releasing chemical weapons, what about what happened at Camisea? Can you explain that, Steve?
Sure. Before we talk about Camisea, let's talk about something that's not reported yet. There were over 982 sorties that were flown on 900-some-odd targets in the first Gulf War, where we bombed either known or suspected chemical warfare agent facilities. And that was the whole purpose of degrading Saddam's capability before we begin to fight the first Gulf War. Actually, that's an incorrect term. It's the Gulf War, because we don't know if this next one's going to actually happen yet. So over 982 sites that were known or suspected chemical warfare agent storage facilities or biological storage facilities. That product went up into the atmosphere somewhere and went in a certain direction that's not yet known. And it hasn't really been studied, although the CIA came out with a report that said they've conclusively studied and made sure that nothing would have went over the troops. We really don't know. So In the first Gulf War, again, that's a bad habit. In the Gulf War, veterans who fought it conducted many operations, and one of them was an operation at a place called Camisea. Now, the military did not admit, after veterans returned, that there were any chemical or biological weapons on the battlefield. In fact, they said the three no's, and the three no's were this. No, there were no chemical or biological weapons on the battlefield. Therefore, no one could be sick, and therefore you, who are making this claim, are ill because of stress. And for 7 years after the Gulf War, the department continued to deny that there were even chemical or biological weapons present on the battlefield. Then in 1996, my organization obtained a document through the Freedom of Information Act from UNSCOM, which stated that engineers and UNMOVIC, now UNMOVIC, at that time UNSCOM had identified a place where engineers from the 82nd Airborne had conducted a demolition operation, and the place was known as Camisea. And
Steve Robinson, are you there? Looks like we just lost Steve Robinson. Steve Robinson is executive director of the National Gulf War Resource Center, was a veteran of the Persian Gulf War. I should say, as we get him back on the line, that afterwards we're going to find out about the execution of Lewis Jones. He was executed just as we went to broadcast. He is a Gulf War veteran who said he was exposed to the chemicals of the Camisea, blowing up of the Camisea chemical depot in the Persian Gulf, and that explained what was going on with him. But we have Steve Robinson back on the line. Go ahead, Steve.
Yep, not sure what happened there. At any rate, UNSCOM inspected the site, and they found that there were 37 large ammunition bunkers, and that one of the bunkers, Bunker 73, contained 2,000 chemical warfare agent-filled rockets. And it was obvious that these rockets were part of the demolition operation. So then the Department of Defense admitted, okay, there were chemical and biological weapons on the battlefield, and you did explode them at a place called Camisea, but no one died after you exploded them, so the potential that anybody could have long-term health effects is zero. And they said that because no one had first noticeable effects, that soldiers couldn't possibly be ill. And then they began to try to estimate how many people would have been exposed to these low levels of sarin. At first, they said, well, maybe 100 people were exposed. And they came back a few months later and said maybe 1,000 people were exposed. And right now, as it currently stands, they've estimated that over 140,000 people potentially were exposed to low levels of the nerve agent sarin. Now, that modeling process that they used to make that determination is currently under investigation by the Government Accounting Office. But what's most interesting is that immediately the department said, okay, 140,000 people were exposed, but no one could possibly be ill because the levels of sarin were so low. And what I would say to that now is studies have recently come out. In fact, a study just got released today, but the ones I'm going to refer to recently came out that said low-level exposure to sarin can cause long-term health effects. Because just like there was a time when I was a child, when I looked up at the moon, we really hadn't dominated spaceflight, and going to the moon and landing on it or building the space station was the stuff of comic books. When Gulf War veterans returned from the war and they began to complain of illnesses as a result of exposure, and the department denied them, we knew that science was going to catch up one day, and that credible science and credible reporting would eclipse the denials, and that has in fact come true. The scientific studies are stacking up one on top of one another about how exposure to low-level chemical warfare agent or organophosphates or pesticides or the myriad of things that veterans had been exposed to in the first Gulf War were in fact causal factors in why they were ill. So Camisea was the watershed event, in which the department was forced to admit that chemical warfare agents were on the battlefield. And it's really the reason why we say we're going back to war with Iraq now. But if you look back at history, you'll see that they denied it from 1990 until 1996. And then after they had been shown to have obfuscated the truth, they then began on a campaign to say that stress was the reason why veterans were ill. Now all of those theories have been shot down by credible science. And as we approach the next Gulf War, we're concerned that the soldiers who may be fighting this potential chemical and biological war with Iraq are faced with the exact same mistakes as 1991. And that's why the Government Accounting Office has been asked to conduct an investigation. That's why Christopher Shays will hold a congressional hearing. And that's why these senators are now stepping up to the plate at the last, you know, the last hour, the 59th minute, the 59th second, to say we're concerned. And they're putting their views on the record.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Steve Robinson, Executive Director of the National Gulf War Resource Center. And you are listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, as we turn now to what happened this morning at just about 7 a.m., decorated Gulf War veteran Lewis Jones Jr. executed in Terre Haute, Indiana. President Bush denied his request for clemency last night. The U.S. Supreme Court also refused to block the execution yesterday. Jones was convicted of kidnapping, rape, and the murder of a fellow Army officer in Texas in 95. In 2000, he received a letter from the Pentagon telling him that he had been exposed to nerve agents in the Gulf War. The chemicals were released when the Army demolished a munitions plant in Qamishia, Iraq, in March 91. The Pentagon has since said the chemicals were the nerve agents sarin and cyclosarin. The evidence of Jones' exposure to nerve agents was not available at his trial in 95, though the defense did argue that he suffered from post-traumatic stress disorder. In a letter to President Bush, he admitted that he wantonly took a precious life. He wrote of his victim, quote, "I think of the Marine she was engaged to. I think of the children she could have had. Her son could have discovered a cure for a disease of our time." Mr. Jones, who wrote that he'd become a Christian, asked for clemency so that he could minister to other prisoners for the rest of his life. This morning, about a dozen death penalty opponents held a candlelight vigil just a quarter mile from the prison. A sign leaning against a fence in front of the group said, "The tragic irony. As we rush recklessly to war with Iraq, we're killing a veteran of the first Gulf War." Dick Burr is on the line with us, the attorney for Lewis Jones and a longtime federal death penalty expert. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Well, I know this is a very sad time for you. Within the last hour, Lewis Jones, your client, executed. Can you talk about, we'll make the connection between what we just heard, Steve Robinson talking about Qamishia, and the circumstances of Lewis Jones' case?
Sure. it's really chilling to listen to Steve's quite impressive historical account, because Lewis Jones' crime occurred in early 1995. His trial occurred in late 1995. And there was evidence of brain damage to a part of the deep structure within the brain called basal ganglia that, ironically, the government expert discovered on an MRI. None of the experts for the defense or the government made anything of that at the trial. They just said it's sort of an anomaly in his brain. There was some evidence put on by the defense that Lou Jones was near some nerve gas canisters at some point. The government put on somebody from the Army in response to say, absolutely not, no way, he could not have been exposed to nerve gas. This is in 1995. In 2000, 5 years after Lou Jones had been on death row, the government sent Lou Jones two letters saying that he had been exposed to nerve gas at Qamishia. Of course, they never reached Lou Jones. They were returned addressee unknown. And we only found them after paying an organization several thousand dollars to search through military records and find those documents. And that's the backdrop for Lou Jones. He there's no doubt now that the basal ganglia damage was caused by the sarin. The leading expert for the government, Dr. Robert Haley, who's been the leading researcher on neurological damage as a result of low-level sarin exposure, was the expert in Lou Jones' case. Dr. Haley works in a commission set up by the Veterans Administration to issue authoritative scientific pronouncements about the knowledge we have about Gulf War Syndrome. All of this made no difference to the president. It's really hard to explain how any human being with a mind and a soul could not be responsive to this. Numerous Republicans in the Congress, all of whom are ardent death penalty supporters, came to support Lewis Jones because they intuitively recognized the gross injustice of what had happened.
Well, Dick Burr, I want to thank you for joining us today at this very difficult hour, and I want to have you back on to talk about how you keep going from one case to another with Texas's death row, the busiest in the country. Dick Burr, lawyer for Lewis Jones, who was executed just as we were going to broadcast this morning. You're listening to Democracy Now! Back in a minute.
To the Battle of New Orleans at the end of the early British wars. The young land started growing, the young blood started flowing, but I ain't a marching anymore. For I killed my share of engines in a thousand different fights. I was there at the Little Big Horn. I heard many men lying, I saw many more dying, but I ain't a marching anymore. It's always the old to lead us to the wars, always the young to fall. Now look at all we won with the saber and the gun. Tell me, is it worth it all?
Phil Oakes. I won't be marching anymore. Here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report, I'm Amy Goodman. As we turn to Professor Michael Clare, Five College Professor and Director of Peace and World Security Studies at Hampshire College, talking about American militarism and oil.
Why is oil so important to American strategy? Let me very quickly make the argument. I don't have time to, obviously, to do that in great detail. But essentially, our economy, our way of life, depends on access to abundant and cheap oil. New York City is unusual. It's the only place pretty much in this country where you can get by without an automobile. And I grew up in New York City. I love the city and love the subways and buses. We're very fortunate. Most Americans depend on automobiles to get from one place to another, and our society is hardwired now with interstates and suburbs to rely more and more on automobiles to get around. So suburbs, the construction industry, malls, the automobile industry, steel, pharmaceuticals, petroleum, you know, a good chunk of the American economy runs on oil. And when the price of oil rises, as it does periodically, each time that's happened since World War II, there's been a recession. And we're in that situation now. Our economy is very much sensitive to the availability of oil. I think you're aware of that. I think less obvious is the fact that the American military is equally dependent on oil. We pride ourselves in this country, or some of us do anyway, about how powerful our military is and how it's the best and could do all these wonderful things. You know, you can fly places from this country, drop bombs, and then return to this country. It's an amazing the capacity of the military. But this is a military that entirely depends on oil. It wouldn't function for 30 seconds without oil. Its tanks, its planes, its ships, all of them rely on oil. We're very capital intensive, machine intensive, and oil intensive military. And that's been America's forte, is the ability to overpower enemies with machines. That's been the essence of our military policy since World War II. And we must have oil to do that. We cannot fight our wars without it. at least we could go back to sailing ships and send our Marines over that way. But that's what we would be reduced to. So oil is essential. And one third point I want to make is there's something ironic about this, whether you believe in the Almighty or Mother Nature or random chance or whatever you believe in, how the Earth was formed. There's an irony in all of this. Mother Nature provided this country with a very large supply of oil, one of the largest in the world. It was the first to be discovered in 1859 in Titusville, Pennsylvania, and the first to be developed on a very large scale. And it was the development of oil that created the great corporations, the modern American multinational corporations, Standard Oil of New York, Standard Oil of New Jersey, the Rockefellers, Standard Oil, now ExxonMobil and the other big oil corporations, and our way of life, the suburban way of life that developed Long Island, New Jersey, all of that was product of the fact that this country was well endowed with oil. But we were the first to develop our oil, the first to use it up. And we're using it up at a very rapid rate, and we have been for quite some time. Also, Mother Nature, in her wisdom, or maybe she's laughing at us, put the rest of the world's oil in the Middle East, with a little bit in Russia and the Caspian Sea, a little bit in Colombia and Venezuela, some in the west coast of Africa, but two-thirds or more is in the Middle East. Whether this was some kind of trick on us or a statement or whatever, we have become dependent on a product which is only found in the Middle East, and we can't do without it. This is the dilemma. This dilemma first became apparent to American leaders in World War II, and it was Franklin Roosevelt's administration that first saw all of these three come together. The U.S. won World War II with its oil. Of course, you know that the atom bomb sort of set the stage, ended the final few days of the war, but Japan was already defeated. Germany was defeated by that point, and it was not our superior weapons. Germany had better weapons than we did, and it was not our industrial or strategic military superiority. Germany was better in all those things. We had oil, they didn't. So we could pump oil into our planes and tanks in the final battles. Germany couldn't, and we won the war. Japan ran out of oil because submarines destroyed all their tankers. They didn't have any. They ran out of oil. I mean, maybe I'm exaggerating this, but certainly for Franklin Roosevelt, this was at the center of their thinking. He died before the bomb was dropped. For him, oil was what made the U.S. win the war. And he knew we were running out, that the U.S. was running out of oil, and that we were going to need it for our military and economic superiority. And to make a long story short, his solution was to take over Saudi Arabia. Now, originally his plan was to do this by creating a state-owned, American government-owned corporation, the Strategic Reserves Corporation, Petroleum Reserves Corporation, copied on British Petroleum, which was a state-owned company. Now BP is now privatized, but it was a British government. It was a government corporation because the British government wanted control of oil for national security purposes. FDR wanted to set up an American corporation to own Saudi Arabian oil and to protect it with American troops as a national security measure. Congress didn't go along with that, so he had to agree to form a partnership between the government as the protector and the corporations pumping the oil, because then they sort of had to get the people, the rulers of Saudi Arabia to go along with this plan. So in 1945, FDR met with King Abdulaziz ibn Saud on the carrier, the USS Quincy, in the Suez Canal, the leader of the free world, meeting with a potentate who brought his slaves on board American ships. Saudi Arabia didn't abolish slavery until the 1960s. At that time, when a king went somewhere, he went with his entourage of slaves. That's what kings of Saudi Arabia did in those days. And so FDR there on one side, King Abdulaziz on that side with the slaves, and they worked out a deal where the U.S. government would protect the royal family in perpetuity, generation to generation. We're now three, well, the king officially is the son of Abdulaziz, but the person running the country, Prince Abdullah, is the grandson of Ibn Saud. And we have a pact to protect the royal family in perpetuity, not Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is the property of the king, but to the dynasty. We have an arrangement with the dynasty to protect the dynasty against its enemies in return for access to Saudi Arabian oil, which continues to govern American policy. I'd love to go and tell you the whole story. It's such a fascinating story. But the essence of this is that this created a requirement for the United States. First of all, it created a dependency on Saudi Arabia. Then it produced a requirement for the United States to protect our dependent relationship with Saudi Arabia up until this day, not only to protect the kingdom against its external enemies, but also the dynasty against its internal enemies. And I wish I could say more about all of that. But over the past, so to condense the story, since 1945, the basis, the fulcrum of American policy in the Middle East, especially in the Persian Gulf, is the protection of Saudi Arabian oil. And I want to emphasize that this predated the creation of the State of Israel and the security arrangements subsequently made with Israel. Our relationship with Saudi Arabia is older and much more central to American strategic planning ever since. And so out of this arrangement came the deployment of American forces in the Persian Gulf. It led over time to an ever-increasing deployment of American forces, although we did like to use surrogates when we could. We turned Iran into a surrogate. When the Shah was overthrown in Iraq, when the Shah was overthrown in 1979, 1980, in Iraq invaded Iran, and then this was after the hostage crisis, then the Iranians repelled the Iraqi invasion and started coming around in the direction of Kuwait and Saudi Arabia. The U.S. responded by turning Saddam Hussein into a surrogate for the United States. And Donald Rumsfeld, that great champion of human rights and democracy, was sent to embrace Saddam Hussein in December 1983 after it was reported that Iraq was using chemical weapons on, quote, a daily basis, unquote, against Iranian troops. Donald Rumsfeld went to Baghdad, embraced Saddam Hussein, showered him with gifts paid for by the American taxpayer, including satellite data that on Iranian troop positions, which it facilitated the use of chemical weapons by the Iraqi army. So the U.S. is complicit in the Saddam Hussein, or at least the current leadership of the U.S. government. Donald Rumsfeld in particular, and Dick Cheney, who became Secretary of Defense in 1989 and continued to supply this intelligence data to Saddam Hussein, is complicit in the Hussein regime and in the use of weapons of mass destruction. And you notice that in the 1980s, they had no moral compunction about using chemical weapons. This is when they fulminate about the terrible things that Saddam Hussein did with his chemical weapons, killing his own people. At the time, they didn't say anything about this. In the time, they facilitated the use of chemical weapons by Saddam Hussein. That does not deserve applause. That deserves some other kind of rude noises. Yes. That's right. Yes. I'm sorry, I want to make a few more points and try to bring this up to show you how American militarism and oil are intertwined. The next stage in the story is after the U.S. backed Saddam Hussein, he thought, what objection would we have to Saddam Hussein invading Kuwait. I don't know what went through his mind. Certainly nobody was telling him at the time that you're a bad guy and you're going to get in trouble. We continued to provide him with economic assistance well into 1990, doubled economic assistance under the Bush regime, Bush administration senior. So he must have thought he had a free hand. But once he invaded Kuwait, it put his troops on the border with Saudi Arabia, and the Saudi Arabian oil fields are very close to the Kuwait border. This set off alarm bells in Washington. This was a threat to Saudi Arabia. Remember, that's the essence of our policy, is protecting Saudi Arabia. So we sent troops there. President Bush announced on August 8, 1990, when on national television, many of you will remember, he said, we've drawn a line in the sand. It wasn't just out in the desert somewhere. It was the line on this, between the oil fields and Iraqi troops. And he said, we can't allow the Iraqis to cross that line and take the oil fields and gain control over our economy and destroy our economy. We had to resist with military force. And that was the onset of Operation Desert Storm. To conduct Operation Desert Storm, President Bush sent his Secretary of Defense, Dick Cheney, to meet with King Fahd, the son of Abdulaziz, in his palace in Riyadh on August 6, 1990. And Cheney pleaded with King Fahd to allow American troops to be based on Saudi territory, which they had resisted because this is the Holy Land, the Islamic Holy Land, tremendous resistance to large numbers of Americans on the soil of Saudi Arabia. King Fahd finally gave in on the extracting the promise that they would be withdrawn as soon as Iraq was driven out of Kuwait, and announcing to his people that they would be withdrawn, fighting objections from dissidents in Saudi Arabia, not dissidents, Muslims who objected to this, including Osama bin Laden, who is a friend of the royal family, friend of the United States, but who pleaded with King Fahd not to allow the Americans in. King Fahd said, well, they'll be gone when the war is over, but when the war was over, they weren't all withdrawn. The U.S. kept a large force in Saudi Arabia to conduct the attacks that continue to this day, Operation Southern Watch, the daily attacks. And this is what started in motion the campaign that we know of as Al-Qaeda, which led to the attacks on September 11th. The attacks of September 11th are directly related to this historical relationship that I've described between the United States and the Saudi royal family. That is what 9/11 is about, and the continuing Al-Qaeda struggle is to drive the United States out of Saudi Arabia and to replace the Saudi royal family with a government that's not corrupted by its ties with the U.S. and U.S. oil companies.
Michael Clare, professor of peace studies at Hampshire College, speaking at the Not In Our Name conference this past weekend. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. Our website is www.democracynow.org. Our email address, mail@democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening. From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Terrorists and terror states do not reveal these threats with fair notice in formal declarations. And responding to such enemies only after they have struck first is not self-defense, it is suicide. The security of the world requires disarming Saddam Hussein now.
President Bush calls for a first strike attack against Iraq without UN backing. Meanwhile, opponents to Bush's push for war are staging protests and civil disobedience across the country.
Hi, yesterday, scores of people were arrested at the Capitol in Washington, at the U.S. mission to the United Nations in New York, and around the country. The protests grow. The anti-war movement will not be silenced.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Bush last night vowed to attack Iraq if President Saddam Hussein and his sons do not flee the country within 48 hours. The Iraqi government immediately rejected the ultimatum. Bush also told Iraqi soldiers not to fight for a dying regime and not to destroy Iraq's oil wells. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan ordered the evacuation of weapons inspectors and humanitarian staff from Iraq. The first wave of UN workers has already landed in Cyprus. Annan also suspended the Oil for Food program. Bush's speech came just hours after the United States and Britain admitted they'd failed to win UN Security Council backing for war. They pulled the second UN resolution without taking a vote. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan challenged the legitimacy of unilateral military action, but refrained from branding it illegal. In Britain, three ministers have already resigned. The leader of the British House of Commons, Robin Cook, resigned just after the United States and Britain pulled the UN resolution. His resignation speech late last night was met with an unprecedented round of applause and a standing ovation by some members of Parliament. Today, British Home Office Minister John Denham and Health Minister Lord Hunt of King's Heath also resigned. But International Development Secretary Claire Short announced she would stay in her cabinet post despite earlier threats to resign. Russian President Vladimir Putin called for a peaceful resolution, said a U.S. attack would have, quote, the gravest consequences. Meanwhile, the Russian parliament delayed ratification of a major nuclear disarmament treaty with the United States. A parliamentary spokesperson said the decision was made after Bush's declaration and, quote, in the conditions of the massive U.S. pressure on the international community. French Foreign Minister Dominique de Villepin denounced the United States for pulling the resolution from the UN. He said a wide majority of the 15 members of the Security Council oppose the U.S. He said the U.S., Britain, and Spain are resorting to force, quote, despite the clearly expressed will of the international community. German Chancellor Gerhard Schroeder said today there is no justification for war that will, quote, bring certain death to thousands of innocent men, women, and children. Chinese Premier Wen Jiabao opposed Bush's ultimatum to Saddam Hussein and held out hope for a diplomatic solution. This news just in from Yemen. An American, a Canadian, and a Yemeni were shot dead in an attack by a Yemeni gunman who then killed himself at an oil field east of Sana'a. The U.S. government raised its terrorist threat level to orange or high risk last night as President Bush was delivering his speech on Iraq. Top federal officials asked states to deploy the National Guard or state police to protect sensitive sites across the nation from possible attack. A Vatican spokesperson, Archbishop Renato Rafael Martino, told Vatican Radio, quote, war is a crime against peace, which cries for vengeance before God. He said war is deeply unjust and immoral and said God condemns war because civilians suffer the most. Martino is the Vatican's former permanent representative to the United Nations. He strongly denounced the Bush administration, saying, quote, do not reply with a stone to the child who asks for bread. He said, they are preparing to reply with thousands of bombs to a people that has been asking for bread for the last 12 years. The Turkish government and military leaders have reached agreement on allowing U.S. troops to use Turkey as a northern front in an attack on Iraq. The cabinet will discuss the measure today, and Parliament could take up the issue tomorrow. Meanwhile, protesters are engaging in daily nonviolent direct actions around the country this week. Over 50 people were arrested in Washington, D.C. yesterday. Dozens more were arrested at the United Nations in New York City and San Francisco. There were also arrests in Kentucky, and we'll go to some of those places throughout this hour. Stop the War, Edwin Starr, here on Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Bush last night vowed to attack Iraq if President Saddam Hussein and his sons don't flee the country within 48 hours. The Iraqi government rejected the ultimatum. Bush addressed the nation on primetime television.
All the decades of deceit and cruelty have now reached an end. Saddam Hussein and his sons must leave Iraq within 48 hours. Their refusal to do so will result in military conflict commenced at a time of our choosing. For their own safety, all foreign nationals, including journalists and inspectors, should leave Iraq immediately. Many Iraqis can hear me tonight in a translated radio broadcast, and I have a message for them. If we must begin a military campaign, it will be directed against the lawless men who rule your country and not against you. As our coalition takes away their power, we will deliver the food and medicine you need. We will tear down the apparatus of terror, and we will help you to build a new Iraq that is prosperous and free. In a free Iraq, there will be no more wars of aggression against your neighbors, no more poison factories, no more executions of dissidents, no more torture chambers and rape rooms. The tyrant will soon be gone. The day of your liberation is near. It is too late for Saddam Hussein to remain in power. It is not too late for the Iraqi military to act with honor and protect your country by permitting the peaceful entry of coalition forces to eliminate weapons of mass destruction. Our forces will give Iraqi military units clear instructions on actions they can take to avoid being attacked and destroyed. I urge every member of the Iraqi military and intelligence services, if war comes, do not fight for a dying regime that is not worth your own life. And all Iraqi military and civilian personnel should listen carefully to this warning. In any conflict, your fate will depend on your actions. Do not destroy oil wells, a source of wealth that belongs to the Iraqi people. Do not obey any command to use weapons of mass destruction against anyone, including the Iraqi people. War crimes will be prosecuted. War criminals will be punished. And it will be no defense to say, I was just following orders. Should Saddam Hussein choose confrontation, the American people can know that every measure has been taken to avoid war. And every measure.
President Bush speaking last night to the nation, announcing the 48-hour ultimatum. You are listening to Democracy Now! As we turn first to Jeremy Scahill, Democracy Now! Correspondent who's just come out of Iraq. Welcome, Jeremy. Your response to this message to the Iraqi people as well?
Well, you know, I've spent a lot of time in the south of Iraq where the population is predominantly Shiite, and it's particularly relevant, the history of the people in the south of Iraq regarding made by men with the last name of Bush. In February of 1991, George Bush the Elder called on the Iraqi people to, quote, take matters into their own hands. to rise up against Saddam Hussein, saying that the United States would back them. And when a blitzkrieg operation, a rebellion, spread across Iraq and took control of 14 of the country's 18 provinces, George Bush the Elder refused to support this Iraqi rebellion that had Saddam Hussein on the ropes. In fact, Norman Schwarzkopf stood by and refused to meet with the leaders of that rebellion against Saddam Hussein. George Bush the Elder lifted the air exclusion zone on Iraqi aircraft, and the special Republican Guard units flew into the south of Iraq and mercilessly crushed the rebellion that ultimately would have threatened Saddam Hussein's very existence. Now in the south of Iraq, people remember that history very well. And on top of that, they've lived for 12 years with regular U.S. bombing, and they suffer the most from the U.S.-led sanctions. So I think that these words from George W. Bush about protecting ordinary Iraqis and helping them to liberate themselves or to liberate the country is going to be met with a lot of disdain. I think one of the things to see is if U.S. forces come into the south of Iraq, it's quite possible that most Iraqis would indeed stay in their homes and let the U.S. forces move through, fearing that they would face a very, very severe slaughter on the part of U.S. forces. But it's also possible that the sentiment against the United States because of this 12 years of punishment is so strong that people will resist. And so U.S. forces could face the prospect of not secular Iraqis attacking them, but Shiite Iraqis who believe that the U.S. has no business stepping its feet on yet another strip of Islamic holy land. And the south of Iraq contains two of the holiest cities in Shiite Islam, Najaf and Karbala. So I think that this is going to be met with a lot of disdain, particularly among the southern Shiite Iraqis.
And those in Baghdad, the Operation Shock and Awe, how people are preparing right now, and George Bush saying that medicine and food is on the way.
As I was leaving Baghdad a few days ago, I noticed that the streets of the capital city have gotten a lot barer. Many Iraqis that I know were in the last stages of beginning to leave Baghdad, some of them moving to more rural areas in Iraq, some of them trying to cross over into Syria. Many of them ended up stranded at the border of Jordan already. Also, Iraqis are talking about going to Iran, but their fears are very complicated. Yes, many people have heard through shortwave radio or friends or relatives abroad that the U.S. is going to hit Baghdad with 3,000 cruise missiles just in the opening days of a war. That certainly scares people. But Iraqis are very fond of saying when they talk about the prospect of a U.S. war that the wet man is not afraid of the rain. Iraqis say that they're not going to be going to bomb shelters because the United States did them last time. But also Iraqis are afraid that a U.S. attack against Iraq will spur Saddam Hussein, if he has them, to use chemical or biological weapons, not against U.S. forces, but against Iraqis who rebel. You have very large Shiite neighborhoods in Baghdad, one of them a well-known slum called Saddam City. Many of the people who live in that area are from the south of Iraq, and to put it quite bluntly, they hate the government. Some of them talk of the specific Baathists, the members of Saddam Hussein's Ba'ath Party, that they're going to, quote, kill when they get the opportunity to. And so I think that it's possible that we're going to see the inverse of what happened in 1991, where you'll have rural Iraqis potentially staying in their homes while Baghdadians rebel against the Iraqi government. And many ordinary Iraqis are afraid that Saddam Hussein has plans to use chemical or biological weapons against them as a result of the United States attacking them. But across the board, Iraqis say they don't believe that Saddam Hussein would even think of using a non-conventional weapon if it weren't for George W. Bush and his attack.
Jeremy Scahill, just out of Iraq right now. On the line with us also, Ralph Nader, former Green Party candidate for president. You have been a part of a coalition of people who have sent letters to President Bush, organizations of veterans, of unions, of various groupings of former senators to meet with Bush on the issue of an attack on Iraq.
Yes. Every major group that's opposed to this reckless war has sent a letter to President Bush over the last 7 weeks asking for a meeting and explaining why. They haven't had the courtesy of a reply. This is a president who has a closed mind. He's a messianic militarist. He has refused to meet with groups like the National Council of Churches, union groups, business groups, veteran groups, student groups, environmental groups, human rights groups in the White House. He's refused to meet with them anywhere. He's never met with an anti-war delegation. The Council of Churches had to fly to London and spent 45 minutes with Tony Blair, but they couldn't see their own president. And these are groups that represent a huge cross-section of the American people. They represent tens of millions of Americans. And this illustrates the syndrome of an obsessively compulsed president who has a closed mind and who's not willing to have any information input that might be contrary to the cluster of chicken hawks both in and around the White House that, against the advice of many retired generals, admirals, and intelligence officials, are pushing the nation to war.
We also have with us in the studio Leslie Kagan, who is coordinator of the United for Peace and Justice Coalition. Coming up, we're going to hear from people around the country what they're doing. Scores of people have already been arrested. Leslie Kagan, your response to what George Bush has put forward, the 48-hour ultimatum for war with Iraq.
Well, of course, it's obviously extremely upsetting that this president, and not just the president, the team of men around him, just refused to listen not only to the population of this country, but literally millions and millions of people all around the world, and most of the governments of the world, that they just don't care. They just put all that aside and forge ahead with their plans for war. It doesn't come as a terrific surprise. We all knew this was unfolding and coming. We all, of course, continue to work extremely hard to try and stop this. Until the bombs start falling, we hold on to some hope, some belief that the will of the people, not only in this country, but the global will of the people will be a force strong enough to actually stop George Bush. At the same time, though, we are realistic. We are grounded in the reality of the moment here and understand that he is on a course, he's driven to make this war happen, he and, again, the men around him. But this will not discourage the anti-war movement. We will simply shift gears from a movement trying to prevent a war from happening to a movement working as hard as we can day and night to end a war once it begins.
Robin Cook, the leader of the British House of Commons, resigned just after the U.S. and Britain pulled the U.N. resolution from consideration. Two more ministers in Britain have also resigned. Let's take a listen to Robin Cook's resignation.
What has come to trouble me most over past weeks is the suspicion that if the hanging chads in Florida had gone the other way and Al Gore had been elected, we would not now be about to commit British troops. Mr. Speaker, the longer I have served in this place, the greater the respect I have for the good sense and the collective wisdom of the British people. On Iraq, I believe the prevailing mood of the British people is sound. They do not doubt that Saddam is a brutal dictator, but they are not persuaded he is a clear and present danger to Britain. They want the inspections to be given a chance. And they suspect that they're being pushed too quickly into conflict by a US administration with an agenda of its own. Above all, they are uneasy at Britain going out on a limb in a military adventure without a broader international coalition and against the hostility of many of our traditional allies. From the start of the present crisis, as leader of this House, I've insisted on the right of this place to vote on whether Britain should go to war. It has been a favorite theme of commentators that this House no longer occupies a central role in British politics. Nothing could better demonstrate that they are wrong than for this House to stop the commitment of troops in a war which has neither international agreement nor domestic support. I intend to join those tomorrow night who vote against military action now. It is for that reason, and that reason alone, and with a heavy heart, that I resign from the government.
That was leader of the British House of Commons, Robin Cook. His resignation speech was met with an unprecedented round of applause and a standing ovation by some members of Parliament. When we return, we'll also be joined by Mike Marcuzzi, organizer with the Stop the War Coalition, speaking to us from London. Then we'll speak to Mairead McGuire, Nobel Peace Prize laureate, who was just arrested in New York. And we'll go down to Lexington, Kentucky, to an arms depot and find out about the government threatening to use deadly force against protesters who go to Vandenberg Air Force Base in California. Stay with us.
I see through it now, but I didn't at first. The hypocrites made it worse and worse.
Looking down the nose is what people say. These are just words and words, okay. It's what you do and not what you say. If you're not part of the future, then get out of the way. Come on, baby, take a ride with me. I'm up from Indiana down to Tennessee. Everything is cool as can be in a peaceful world.
To what Martin Luther King had to say. I don't want my kids being brought up this way. Hatred to each other is not okay.
Well, I'm not afraid of just to sing a song. Yeah. I can see more to be done.
John Mellencamp, Peaceful World, here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman as we continue to get response to President Bush's ultimatum 48-hour countdown to war. We're joined by Leslie Kagan, coordinator of the United for Peace and Justice Coalition, as well as Mike Marcuzzi, who's with the Stop the War Coalition in London. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Mike.
Hi, Amy.
Can you tell us what's happened now in London, the significance of Robin Cook, the head of the House of Commons, resigning along with two others?
Yeah, this is a real measure of the crisis that's been generated by the huge public rejection of Blair's claims and justifications for the war. And it's boiled up from the grassroots, getting more intense over the last few weeks, culminating with the huge 2 million-strong demonstration in London on the 15th of February. And it's now shaking the cabinet itself. The resignation of a senior cabinet figure who is also someone who is hugely respected and known across the labor movement, including the trades union, is a huge blow to Blair. It's left British politics in considerable disarray. The House of Commons is debating right now, as we're talking, and there will be a vote on an anti-war amendment later this evening. It's a cross-party amendment, and a great deal will depend on how big that vote is. In particular, how many Labour MPs, members of Parliament from Tony Blair's own party, rebel against the party whip and say no to war.
Yet Clare Short, the International Development Secretary, who threatened to resign if Blair didn't go for a second vote at the UN Security Council, says she will not resign now.
I have to say I'm not in the least surprised by that. People who are familiar with British Labour politics over many years have seen Clare Short do this kind of thing in the past. And I have to say honestly that I don't think many people in the anti-war movement look to her for any kind of leadership.
The significance of Home Office Minister John Denham resigning.
Yeah, again, these are people who have stuck with Blair for a fairly long time through some and made a lot of compromises in order to do so. Many of them started on the left 20 or more years ago. But they have reached a bottom line with this, and it's quite striking how many members of Parliament who in the past have gone along with previous wars, previous militaristic exercises, have drawn the line here. And they've been forced to do that, really, by the transformation in the public mood and the public debate, which is reflected on every radio phone-in show and every opinion poll and every audience participation format in the media of any kind.
Bob Blizzard, Labour MP, resigns as private parliamentary secretary to work in pensions minister Nick Brown.
Yeah.
Anne Campbell, Labour MP for Cambridge, resigning her role as private parliamentary secretary to Patricia Hewitt, secretary of state for trade and industry. So we have at least five resignations.
That's right. No, it's building up, and there may well be more coming. We have to draw a distinction, I should explain, between ministers and cabinet members. I mean, cabinet members are more, it's a much more exclusive club. You know, and so far we've only had Robin Cook, though that is a very huge blow to Blair, as I said. I think there will be more coming. I think, as I said before, what's most significant is the numbers in the vote tonight, because while Blair will get a majority for his war position thanks to the support of the Conservatives, it will be extremely difficult for him if that majority is overwhelmingly dependent on the Conservatives. In other words, if a majority of his own backbenchers actually rebel against him.
We're also joined on the line by Mairead McGuire, who's come from Ireland and got arrested in front of the United Nations yesterday. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you very much indeed. Good morning, Amy.
It's good to have you with us, Mairead McGuire, Nobel Peace Laureate from Ireland. Can you talk about why you got arrested and what you did?
Yes, Amy. Well, we came from Belfast carrying with us a lot of messages to take them to the United Nations to say no to war and yes to peace. And we got arrested yesterday outside the United Nations. I didn't take this decision to get arrested lightly, but I really feel that we are in a situation in the world today where we have to obey our conscience and obey the higher law of love and say no to man-made laws which are going to cause the death of thousands and thousands of innocent civilians. So people have to make a choice now according to their own conscience.
Beth Rosedetter is also on the line with us, arrested on Sunday at an Army depot in Lexington, Kentucky. She had just come out of jail. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Beth.
Hi.
Can you talk about what you did?
Well, we've been blocking the gate to the Army depot once a month for 3 months now. And this time we intended to stay for as long as possible. So we actually set up a tent in front of the gate and, you know, moved in. We didn't know whether we'd be staying for a week or a day or what, but they arrested us Sunday night.
And why did you choose the Army Depot you did? What is its formal name?
It's the Bluegrass Army Depot, and they do a lot of things there. We have a part of the U.S. chemical weapons stockpile there. And they're working on getting rid of those, I guess. But a lot of a majority of the small arms ammunition that'll be used in the Gulf War comes through our depot. So we think it's important for Americans to realize that, you know, this war machine isn't happening somewhere else. It's in all of our communities. You know, we've got one little piece of it here. There aren't many communities in the U.S. that don't have a piece of the mobilization going on right there. So, you know, we're trying to take care of our little part. And if other people take care of their little parts, the war can't go forward.
Mike Marcuzzi of the Stop the War Coalition in London, your group has announced that you are having a news conference to outline your protest plans as people take to the streets all over the world right now. Can you talk about what the plans are in London?
Yeah. There are already large numbers of people gathering outside of Parliament, and that will increase as the day goes on towards evening when the vote's taken place. But what we've said is that on the day the bombing or the attack actually starts, we're calling on people the following noon to walk out of their offices, their factories, their shops, their classes, whatever. And the anti-war movement on a local level has been very effective at identifying areas and locales for people to assemble. When that happens, and I think that in very large numbers people will walk out. There is a serious likelihood of industrial action, strikes over this, although they will be illegal. It is illegal in Britain to strike on a non-work-related issue. Nonetheless, it's clear that train drivers and the people who drive our tubes, our underground railroad in London, will probably stop the trains, stop the tubes. Some 35 civil servants union branches have announced that they will be walking out when and if the war stops. A large number of university students will certainly take action, and indeed there are several thousand school students who are already organized and already have these plans ready to roll when it becomes necessary. There will then be, at 6 p.m. on the day the war starts, or at the 6 p.m. following when the war starts, we're asking people to assemble in their town centers, city centers all over the country, and especially, of course, in the center of London, outside Parliament, outside Downing Street, in the Ministry of Defense on Whitehall. And I expect a really huge and very, very angry crowd to turn out for that. And then this coming Saturday, in common, of course, with you in New York and people all over the world, we will be having a national demonstration in London. And although, of course, the notice is short, and we don't have the time that we had to build up to the 15th of February, we would expect a turnout of many hundreds of thousands. And I would expect the mood in Britain to be very angry and very militant, because we've clearly been taken into a war against the will of the majority of the people here.
Mike Marcuzzi speaking to us from London, the Stop the War Coalition. You mentioned Saturday, Leslie Kagan. You're spearheading that effort in New York on February 15th. The numbers were huge. We'll never know, really,
yes,
those numbers, because so many people were kept away by police from the First Avenue protest of at least 500,000 people. What about Saturday?
Well, Saturday this time we actually have a permit to march. As people will remember, the city and the federal judges decided that we did not have a right to march in the streets of New York on February 15th. So we went back to the police and said, well, we're going to be demonstrating again. This time we want to march. So actually we won that this time. It's actually a very, very important victory, because part of this war, we will see, I believe, the increase of the attack and the curtailment of civil liberties, which has already begun in this country, but we're going to see more and more of that here. So the right to march was a very important part of our struggle. We are marching on Saturday here in New York. We invite people from around the region to join us. We'll be assembling on Broadway, south of Times Square, south of 42nd Street, between 6th and 7th Avenues on the side streets there, and we'll be marching right through the heart of Manhattan, ending up at Washington Square Park. But between now and then, we'll also see flowering. I was going to say an outburst, but really it's a flowering of protests, demonstrations, marches and rallies and vigils and nonviolent civil disobedience, not only here in New York, but around the country. In fact, United for Peace and Justice and many of the other anti-war coalitions around the country are actively calling, urging people to be on the streets as much as possible, not only today and tomorrow, but the day this war begins, the day after this war begins. And we urge you to use our website. Let us know what's happening. Go to the calendar, list your activities, so we can project this to the national media and let the national media know that this anti-war movement is not going away.
Jesse Jackson is joining you on Saturday,
yes,
in March.
Yes, Jesse Jackson has agreed to come in and will march with us. Quite a number of elected officials from the New York area, religious leaders, labor unions, students. There should be a tremendous student contingent. Again, I don't think we'll see quite the numbers that we saw on February 15th, but this will be a tremendous demonstration. We're not having any rally this time. This is the time for people to march with our signs and our banners and our chants and our songs, and our message will be heard. And the president might act as if he doesn't care, and maybe he really doesn't care, but the people are not going away. The people's voice will be heard here in New York on Saturday, and I believe in many other cities around the country, and certainly around the world, people will continue to be out on the streets.
This news from around the world. In Sydney, people painted a 3-meter-high no war slogan across the top of part of the city's opera house. Protesters also made their voices heard in Australia's parliament, where one man in the public gallery screamed murderer as the Prime Minister John Howard announced his decision to commit 2,000 troops to an Iraq invasion force. The man was dragged from the chamber by security guards. In Tokyo, just hours after Japan's Prime Minister gave full backing to the U.S. push for war, peace activists began a hunger strike outside the U.S. embassy. In Pakistan, more than 100 school and college students marched through the city of Rawalpindi near Islamabad, demanding a jihad holy war against the U.S., waving placards and banners reading, "No war for oil. Bush is the real sign of terrorism. Hate America, love Islam." In the Philippines, at least 2 people were injured as riot police used truncheons and water cannon to disperse anti-war protesters in front of the U.S. embassy. Police in Indonesia, the world's most populous Muslim country, said they were stepping up security at foreign embassies. The move comes in preparation for the massive street protests expected in the wake of George Bush's ultimatum for war. Just a few of the examples of what people are doing. Meanwhile, U.S. military officials say security forces at Vandenberg Air Force Base in California may use deadly force against protesters if they infiltrate the base in wartime. Vandenberg officials said Friday military police may shoot to kill in order to protect equipment at the base. But activists say the threat will not deter them. They're planning continuous civil disobedience at the base if the U.S. attacks Iraq. On Friday, a man sprayed the entrance sign at the base with his own blood. We're joined right now by Peter Lumsdaine, co-founder of the Vandenberg Action Coalition and coordinator of the Military Globalization Project. Peter, can you lay out for us what exactly is the Vandenberg Air Force Base and the significance of the U.S. government coming out and saying they could kill protesters if they approach it in wartime?
Yes, Amy, I think it's actually very important to clarify what the government did and didn't say, and it's even more important to clarify exactly the role of Vandenberg in this coming assault on Iraq. Many people who've heard of Vandenberg tend to think of it as a missile test facility, and it is. They continuously fire Minuteman III and MX missiles, basically dress rehearsals for World War III, but there's another function of the base which is even more critical, and it's absolutely central to the operational attack plan for Iraq, and that is the fact that the base is the location of what's called the Aerospace Operations Center, which is a worldwide command and control nerve center for the matrix, if I can use that word, of military satellites circling the planet. And as in Desert Storm, and even more so in this looming assault, those satellites, navigation, guidance, weapons direction, targeting satellites, are going to be absolutely crucial to the air and ground assault on Iraq. There, Vandenberg is the headquarters of what's called the 14th Air Force, that is the command and control center for the targeting and weapons guidance satellites around the world. So every bomber that goes into Iraq, every B-1, every B-2, every B-52, every attack plane, every special forces commando unit is going to get sealed military commands and direction and targeting coordinates through this matrix of satellites that Vandenberg is the control hub for. And that's why we have planned this resistance campaign and resistance action there, and we have found that the base actually has the potential. It has the potential to be significantly disrupted by the breaching of its inner security zones. It's very large, 98,000 acres, and they have off-limit security zones that must be maintained without unauthorized personnel entering them. So that's what people are planning to do, is to nonviolently hike into these inner security zones, to breach those security zones, which we know will trigger disabling alerts at the base, and people may be doing other forms of nonviolent resistance inside of the base as well. But in terms of the statement, just to clarify that, I think it's important for people to realize that this policy has been on the books for years, for decades. The Vandenberg Action Coalition has a 21-year history there at the base. We've recently reorganized and revived this campaign because of the looming attack on Iraq. And this policy basically says what any urban police department would say, that if people are attacking base personnel, which we've never done in 21 years, or if they are in the middle of committing a major felony, destroying a $1 million piece of machinery or something like that, they reserve the right to draw their guns and use them. I mean, I think it's really reprehensible to say that you would shoot someone over a piece of machinery, but this is something which is common in law enforcement around the country. So I don't think that's different. I think what is different is that they're trying rather desperately to scare people off from this base, because they realize that we have recognized Vandenberg and its satellite command center, Aerospace Operations Center, as the what would you say, the high-tech SOA of the 21st century, the WTO of military globalization, of global military power. And that's why we are planning this action there, and that's why they're trying to scare people off.
We're also joined by Dennis Appel, who was arrested on Friday at Vandenberg. He is speaking to us from a monastery. Will this change your action?
Pardon me, Amy, I didn't hear.
Can you talk about the action you engaged in on Friday, and if this latest threat by the U.S. military would change your future actions?
No,
the latest threat, I agree with Peter. I think that it's a scare tactic. I don't believe that the base has any authority to claim a right to shoot to kill protesters. I went on Friday out to the base to spray my blood on their sign because the stated intention of our government is to drop between 300 and 400 cruise missiles on Baghdad in the first 24 hours of the war. If our government cares to kill thousands of people without having to witness the consequences of those actions, no one needs to see the death and the destruction when it's done with cruise missiles. I just felt they needed to see some blood. I thought that they shouldn't be protected from seeing the blood that's going to be rolling in the streets of Baghdad. So I went out and sprayed my blood on their sign, and they were very reserved and kind to me. No one shot at me, and I don't expect them to shoot at any protesters.
Dennis Apple, who was arrested on Friday. We're going to go to break. When we come back, we'll hear what people are doing all over the country. I want to thank Dennis Apple and Peter Lumsdaine of the Vandenberg Air Action Coalition. Also, Mairead McGuire, Nobel Peace Prize winner, arrested yesterday in New York. Beth Rosedatter, arrested in Lexington, Kentucky. Leslie Kagan of the United for Peace and Justice Coalition, major march in New York on Saturday. But before that, there major protests at Union Square in New York every night at 5 and planned for Times Square if the bombs drop. And this is the case around the country, as we will hear in a minute.
By the river, in a little tent, oh, and just like the river I've been running ever since. Oh, it's been a long time coming, but I know change gonna come. Oh, yes it will. It's been too hard living, but I'm afraid to die, 'cause I don't know what's up there beyond the sky. Oh, it's been a long.
You are listening to Democracy Now! Neville Brothers, Change is Gonna Come. I'm Amy Goodman. This is the War and Peace Report. As the mainstream media continues to cover the preparations for war with their embedded reporters, we bring you reports from around the world from unembedded reporters. But right now we go directly to the source to hear about actions that are planned and are happening as we speak around the country.
I'm Warren Langley, former president of the Pacific Stock Exchange, retired Air Force Lieutenant Colonel, and graduate of the Air Force Academy with 15 years active service. On Friday, I participated in a civil disobedience act blocking the entrance of the stock exchange in San Francisco and blocking traffic and being arrested for the first time in my life. A little bit of a beyond body experience for me, I think, but important enough to try to get the message out. We were trying to stop the war. It looks like the war is going to start despite everybody's good efforts. That means that we need to find now a way to support the troops, but also to change the people who made the wrong policy decisions to start a war. I want to do everything I can and encourage everybody who believes the same way to do everything they can to stop the formation of an American democratic empire. We need to become a citizen of the world like we used to be.
Hello, my name is Diane Scher from the Cleveland Nonviolence Network. If the Bush administration chooses to escalate this war in Iraq, we are planning on transforming a monument in downtown Cleveland called the Soldiers and Sailors Monument from a monument that glorifies war into a peace monument. We plan to do this by draping it with peace cranes and peace chains and large banners that display our message of the cost of war is being too high and that we do support our troops by wanting to bring them home now. We will not stop transforming, even if we are asked to, by the police, and therefore are willing to risk arrest in this action. There are also many people who will be providing support, and we will also have a vigil of remembrance for the people who have died in war, that we hope to respect those who have died by protecting those who are still alive, both the Iraqi citizens and children who will be killed by this terrible war, and also by our own military who are fighting in a war that our government is ill-advised and is not supporting our troops by sending them to a war that is unjustified and illegal.
This is Bill Ramsey with the Human Rights Action Service in St. Louis, Missouri. We have a nonviolent direct action planned, a funeral march to the front gate of the Boeing plant in St. Charles, Missouri, which is making the guidance systems for the smart bombs that will be dropped on Iraq in the event of war. This action is planned for Sunday, the 23rd of this month. In the event of war, we will go to Keener Plaza, which is the major plaza in the middle of the downtown St. Louis, and from there we will march to the Eagleton Federal Court building, and we will form a human chain around that building. We will return to the plaza and remain there overnight in a wake for those who are dying in Iraq, and then on the morning after the war is launched, we will deploy a number of affinity groups to the Boeing plant, to Scott Air Force Base, and to other facilities throughout the St. Louis area that are taking part in the preparations and the implementation of this war.
My name is Missy Bolbecker. I'm the Iraq Campaign Coordinator of the American Friends Service Committee in Austin. We are planning a die-in tomorrow in downtown Austin on March 18th. Activists will gather at an appointed moment and drop dead on the sidewalk, possibly blocking the street, to symbolize the innocent Iraqi civilians who will die in this war. This is part of a week of nonviolent direct action from March 17th to March 24th. On March 24th, we're calling on people to leave work and meet for what is being billed as the Unholy Trinity Tour, Austin's Axis of Evil, the Federal Building, Fox News, and CSC DynCorp, a military contractor heavily involved in the air war on Iraq. There is civil disobedience being planned at the Federal Building where congressional offices are located. At the end of the tour, in front of CSC DynCorp, there will be a Reclaim the Streets party and town hall meeting to set our own agenda to stand up to illegitimate authority and reclaim our democracy.
Hi, I am Moji Aga with Poets Against the War in Tucson, Arizona, and also with Tucson Pledge of Resistance. We have three peaceful protest events scheduled, a major prayer vigil at the Islamic Center on March 19th at 7 p.m., the Poets Against the War's event called the Poets' Brains Chained to the Ground. This is a protest on March 20th at 5:30 p.m., where we will protest the censorship of artistic voices against the war by power. And if the bombs start to drop, we will gather at the Federal Building in downtown Tucson, and we are developing a plan to hold 24-hour ongoing vigils at many places of worship throughout the southern Arizona region until the fire is seized.
Hi, I'm Carolyn Beninsky. I'm with the Rocky Mountain Peace and Justice Center in Boulder and also with the Colorado Coalition Against War in Iraq. And on the day that war starts, we'll be holding a rally at the Boulder County Courthouse, and folks in Denver will be holding a large rally at the State Capitol building. The Colorado Coalition Against War in Iraq has been organizing and carrying out civil disobedience actions for the past 3 months. Last weekend, we did an action at the Buckley Air Force Base in Aurora, Colorado, where 20 people were arrested. Later today, we'll be discussing our next civil disobedience action. So I don't have the details on that yet. We're also organizing people all week to visit their congressional offices to speak out against the war.
My name is Jason Negron Gonzalez. I live in the San Francisco Bay Area, and I'm part of Freedom Rising, which is a coalition of people of color groups that's coming together against the war. We're going to be contributing to the general shutdown of San Francisco that people are planning in the event that war breaks out. So we're going to be blocking some main streets here in San Francisco and being a part of the marches and the disruptions that are going to be happening in the city, basically to send the message that we're not going to sit by at home while the Bush government carries out the murder of Iraqi people and contributes to worse conditions in people of color communities here at home.
I'm Brad Grabs, the chairperson of the Kansas City Iraq Task Force. The day after war breaks out, Kansas Citians plan to gather at a park where we've had protests since early August. We're going to have a rally and a funeral procession through the Country Club Plaza, which is kind of an exclusive shopping district in Kansas City. The funeral procession will include people wearing black, as well as other people wearing white with blood splatters. We're also going to have a die-in at different locations on the plaza to dramatize the effects of war. Later, we're going to do an organizing meeting after that to kind of give people an opportunity to organize in opposition to the war. There's a group, a small group, that's planning a civil disobedience action on April 4th, which is the 35th anniversary of Dr. King's assassination. We're going to highlight Dr. King's beliefs about the Vietnam War, especially in his speech called Beyond Vietnam, and relate that to the current crisis that we're facing today. At our rallies, we expect probably over 2,000 people. Yesterday, we had about 2,500 people out protesting at the candlelight vigil, so we expect a big showing, and we're out there every Sunday at 4 o'clock at 47th and Main. For more information, people can check out our website at www.kciraqtaskforce.org.
My name is Kate Raphael. I'm with Queers Undermining Israeli Terrorism in San Francisco. The day after the war breaks out, we are demonstrating at the local CBS affiliate, KPIX, with big banners made out of duct tape and plastic sheeting that say things like, "Survivor Iraq, there won't be any," because we want to draw attention to the U.S. media's complicity in building the war hysteria and not telling us the truth about what's going on and the huge civilian casualties and all of the massive human cost of this war drive of our government.
I'm Tim Vining, the director of the Thomas Merton Center in Pittsburgh. The Thomas Merton Center is a peace and justice center that's been here in Pittsburgh, focusing on racial and economic justice and nonviolent resistance to war since 1972. At the end of January, we had an anti-war convergence where over 5,000 people took to the streets of Pittsburgh to voice opposition to the war. People cut across all specters of the American public. And then just on yesterday, we had a protest here, a march through Oakland and Shadyside areas of Pittsburgh where we stopped traffic for over 2 hours. Close to 1,000 of us participated in an act of civil disobedience, an unpermitted march. And on the day of an attack against the people of Iraq, we are prepared to shut down the downtown Pittsburgh. We are going to have an unpermitted march throughout the city, blocking traffic to show that it will no longer be business as usual in Pittsburgh if George Bush goes forth with this war against the will of the world opinion and the will of the international community.
Just some of the voices of listeners and viewers around the country. If you'd like to let us know what you're doing, please call us at 212-209-2999. That's 212-209-2999. Our email address, mail@democracynow.org. About 300 New Yorkers gathered yesterday to protest the death of Rachel Corrie, the 23-year-old American woman killed by an Israeli bulldozer on Sunday in the Gaza Strip. Protesters carried gravestones in a symbolic funeral procession. They marched in front of Senators Clinton and Schumer's offices. They demanded the formation of a congressional council to go to Israel and Palestine and investigate the human rights abuses in Gaza. On Sunday, Israeli forces ran Corrie over with a bulldozer as she protested the demolition of houses in the Gaza town of Rafah. Corrie was set to graduate from Evergreen State College in Olympia this spring. She became the first international killed by Israeli forces since the start of the Second Intifada. We go now to Angela Bukawi, who spoke at yesterday's protest. She's a member of the International Solidarity Movement. She recently spent a month in Rafah and begins by describing the ongoing intimidation and danger that Palestinians endure.
It needs to be absolutely clear that there is nothing exceptional or accidental about the IOF running over a peace activist with a bulldozer, shooting at them and generally endangering their lives. It is standard practice of the Israeli military in Rafah. While I was personally in Rafah, every peaceful demonstration that we did was met with tanks and gunfire and gas. They shot our megaphone, they shot our sleeping bags, they shot the tent that we were staying in, they shot a member of the press in his head. Happily, he survived. It's a miracle. The homes that we were staying in with families, and these are ordinary families, were destroyed while activists were in the homes, even though our embassies knew that we were there. We were beaten at the checkpoint at Muwasi, which is an area that's been closed for over 2 years with the denial of medical care. Even doctors and nurses and food are not allowed into Muwasi. We tried to bring 4 bags of medical supplies in, and we were repeatedly shot at and then beaten on the third attempt. The level of violence perpetrated upon the civilian population of Rafah and the activists that live among them is profound, and it exceeds all bounds of humanity. The death of Rachel Corrie is yet another tragic result of the international community's, and specifically America's, failure to recognize the Israeli occupation of the West Bank and Gaza, or the unmitigated exercise in violence that it is. I've also read quite a few myths put out recently by the press according to what happened to Rachel. One source said that the army was using this as a maneuver to find explosives and get rid of tunnels. This is not how they do that. The way they collapse tunnels is to bury large charges in the ground and explode them. This supposedly collapses the tunnels. They do not bring in bulldozers to collapse tunnels. What that actually does, that explosion of a huge amount of TNT, it completely undermines the foundations of homes and allows them to be knocked over more easily. It also terrifies the families that live in there, and so they leave so that the Israeli occupying army can claim that the houses were abandoned. I've also heard that Dr. Samir's home, where this happened in front of, he was a suspected militant, an Islamic militant. I have eaten dinner with Dr. Samir and his beautiful family. He is a pharmacist, not a terrorist. The homes that they have been destroying occupy 100 meters from the Egyptian border to the city of Rafah. And it is a matter of location, not occupation. These homes are being demolished so they can have a security zone. They are wiping out the homes of families. They are demolishing businesses. They are demolishing agricultural land and greenhouses. In Rafah, they grow carnations by hundreds of acres of carnations, and these have been being destroyed as well. Are you going to tell me that carnations are militant as well? I can't believe it. The other and the most offensive thing is coming from the Israeli military itself, saying that her death was an accident. The daily violence of the Israeli occupying forces is not an accident, and it is not acceptable. This is murder, and it was a deliberate murder. And those who are responsible need to be held accountable. Which brings up the larger issue, which is, of course, the occupation of Palestine. Bulldozing homes and people is allied with the practices of shooting people in their homes, the confiscation of land and water, random arrest, imprisonment and torture, the denial of emergency medical services. All of these activities that the IOF are responsible for to crush the economic and political viability of Palestine and to decimate the lives of ordinary people, innocent people. We need to act now to honor the memory of Rachel Corrie and to all of those who have died, to demand a congressional inquiry into the death of this American citizen whose concept of the right to life and liberty extended beyond the borders of her own country.
Angela Bukawi, member of Direct Action Palestine. The event was organized by Jews Against the Occupation. That does it for the show. I want to welcome WSQX, broadcasting now the 2-hour expanded Democracy Now! In Binghamton, Corning area. Welcome to all of you NPR listeners to the Pacifica program, Democracy Now! Democracy Now!'s website is democracynow.org. Our email address, mail@democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Anna Noguera, Mike DeFilippo, our engineer, Elizabeth Press. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.